After returning home, Woodward got in contact with another rancher by the name of Humboldt Puddle. He agreed to host a meeting, and word went out to every rancher and farmer whose land was adjacent to the Long Trek Ranch. He was the oldest of the landowners, and his ranch, Cotto de Bancada, consisted of four sections, making him the largest property owner of the group. Because of his age, property, and the fact that he was a natural leader, the others tended to look to him for direction. It was natural, then, that the meeting took place in his house. Otto Speer was the first to arrive. He was a German who had come to the U.S. just before the Civil War. He'd fought in the war on the side of the North, and after the war, brought his family to Eagle County to homestead a half section of land. Woodward arrived next. He was from Georgia and had fought for the South. When the war ended, there was little left for him to go back to, so he, his wife, and daughter had come to Colorado to homestead. Despite the fact that they had fought on opposite sides, Woodward and Speer were friends. Lucy, who was a very pretty 18-year-old, came to the meeting with her parents and offered to look after the youngsters who came. Herman Drexler was next to arrive. He and his wife had come to Colorado from Pennsylvania. He was followed by Tom Kiefer. He had a spotted past, and though his neighbors may have wondered about him, he proved to be affable and helpful, so no one questioned him. Nobody knew he had once been a road agent down in Texas, and it was money he stole from a stagecoach shipment that gave him the start he'd needed in Colorado. Kiefer wasn't married. The last man to arrive was Chris Logan. He was the first man to speak at the meeting.
I'm gonna have to do something. Ever since Bert Daniels sold out to the Frenchman, my stock has been cut off from water. Frying Pan Creek ran through Daniels' land and onto mine. Now, me and Daniels had us an arrangement where we was sharing that water. Daniels always made certain the creek was flowing, but the water has stopped, and I believe the Frenchman has blocked it of a pure purpose.
What are you doing for water now, Chris?
I'm keeping water in troughs filled with water from a well, but I'm afeard that well's going to run dry.
Tell you what, you can run your cattle across my range. I've got plenty of water.
God, that's damn neighborly of you, Otto.
And that's how we're going to get through this. If we're good neighbors to each other and help each other out when it's needed, the Frenchman will get the idea he can't just buffalo us like he's trying to do.
Hell, the man has more land now than anybody else, Humboldt. What does he want to do? Own the entire county?
He doesn't have more land than anyone else. That's the problem. Smoke Jensen has the most land, and I've heard it said the Frenchman won't stop until Long Trek is bigger than Sugarloaf.
Well, that's not going to happen, Kiefer. He's locked in now. He can't grow any bigger.
Not unless he gets our land. That's what he's after now. He wants to buy us out, or force us to leave.
Well, he'll play hell getting my land, because I ain't selling.
No, and sell my land werde ich nicht tun.
What did he just say?
He said he wouldn't sell his land.
Well, I'm willing to stay as long as all the others are.
I'd like to see us all make that pledge, Herman. I think if we stay together, the Frenchman will quit trying and will leave us alone.
I'm willing to make that pledge.
Logan stuck his hand out. One by one, the others extended their hand until an eight-armed star was formed. Geneva, Switzerland. For 5 months, Inspector Laurent had conducted a diligent search and inquiry of every bank in France, looking for a major depositor, but none could be found. When he was about to report to General Moreau that he had come to a dead end, he got a break. He received a letter from the director of France's International Currency Exchange.
Monsieur Inspector Laurent, I am informed that you have been making inquiries of all banks and financial institutions with regard to large and unexpected monetary deposits. In accordance with your investigation, I can tell you we have recently received a transfer of 2.5 million francs from the Swiss National Bank. The paperwork accompanying the transfer indicated this amount was the result of a transaction with one Antoine Dubois. I hope this information will be of some assistance to you in your investigation. Most sincerely, Jean Arnault, Minister of Finance.
Laurent knew Dubois was dead. If someone made a money exchange in Geneva using the name Dubois, it had to be Mouchette. 2 days after Laurent received the letter, he stepped off a train in Geneva, Switzerland, and went straight to the Swiss National Bank.
Yes, Inspector. A French gentleman by the name of Antoine Dubois did present exactly 2.5 million francs for monetary exchange.
Was this the man?
Laurent showed the bank officer a photograph of Pierre Mouchette.
Yes, sir. I believe this may be the man. But he was not in uniform. He said he was a French businessman. He exchanged the francs for American dollars.
Merci, monsieur. You have been a great help.
At Sugarloaf Ranch, Sally and Smoke Jensen were in the kitchen. Sally was reading a letter from Cal.
What is it?
Miss Sally, me and Pearlie don't mind being here in Denver all that much, what with there being a lot to do, and we know that Smoke needs us over here. But what is so hard is that we ain't had nary one bite of your bear sign in so long, we've near about forgot what they taste like. Could you cook some up and put 'em in a box, then put 'em on a train and have 'em sent here? Wouldn't take more than a day to get them here by train, and more than likely they'd still be good to eat when they got here.
Are you gonna make some bear sign for 'em?
Now, how can I turn down a heartfelt request like that? Yes, I'm going to make some for them. Of course, I'm going to make a few extra.
Sally looked through the window.
Oh, there's Mr. Puddle coming up the road. I wonder what he wants.
Only one way to find out. Hello, Humboldt. Climb down and come on into the house for a cup of coffee.
Thank you. Yep.
Hello, Mr. Puddle. Welcome to Sugarloaf. Why don't you and Smoke go into the parlor? I'll bring you some coffee.
Well, thank you kindly, Sally.
What's on your mind, Humboldt?
Smoke, just how much do you know about this fella Garneau?
Not too much. He doesn't seem to be a man you can get friendly with.
You got that right. You know, don't you, that he's taken over Babcock's place?
Yeah, I heard that he had.
Do you know how he got that ranch?
I haven't heard, but I expect he pulled some sort of deal.
I'll say he did. He paid the taxes on it. That's it, Smoke. He paid the $62 tax on the land and got title to it. And you know the real ironic thing? They found $62 in the sugar bowl in Loy's house. He had the money for the tax and was going to pay it.
I read in the paper that it was a murder-suicide.
You'll never get me to believe that. Not in 1,000 years would I believe that.
I didn't know Babcock that well.
Well, believe me, he wouldn't do a thing like that. It just seems damn convenient to me that both he and Millie wind up dead and Garneau winds up with the title to their property. He's already bought out Daniels and he's been trying to buy everyone else out. But I've managed to hold everyone together so far.
Well, I don't doubt it. You're a man people listen to.
But here's the thing. Am I right in telling everyone else to hold on? I mean, when you get right down to it, ain't none of my business. And even if Garneau didn't have anything to do with killing Babcock, it's still getting pretty ugly.
How?
Well, you take Logan's property, for example. Once Garneau got his hands on Daniel's ranch, he dammed up Frying Pan Creek. Daniels was letting it go on through, so Logan's had water. But now he has none.
That's not good.
And I'm afraid it's going to get worse. I guess what I'm wanting to hear from you, Smoke, is if I'm doing the right thing by keeping everyone together.
What are the others saying? Are they wanting to sell out?
No, sir. We had a meeting at my house and everyone came. And every one of them said they was planning on staying.
Then you aren't forcing them into anything, Humboldt. You're leading them. And any successful group has to have a good leader. I'd say you're doing the right thing.
Thank you, Smoke. To be truthful with you, I think I rode over here just to hear you say that.
Sally came into the room then.
My first batch of bear sign will be out shortly, Mr. Puddle. I do hope you'll stay long enough to have one.
Miss Jensen, if that's a delicious thing I've been smelling ever since I got here, I ain't likely to leave lest I get told to leave.
We're not about to do that.
Then yes, ma'am, it'll be a pleasure to stay.
Long Trek Ranch.
Colonel, I'm gonna be gone for a few days. I'll check in with you when I get back.
Where are you going?
I'm going to take care of what could be a problem for us. Believe me, you're better off not knowing anything about it.
All right. I won't interfere.
Red Cliff, Colorado. Templeton was in town to meet with a man named Jake Willard. A tall man with a narrow face and a badly burned, disfigured cheek. He was a gunman who killed for money. Templeton had money, and he wanted someone killed. He found him sitting in the back of the Moosehead Saloon, drinking beer and dealing poker hands to himself.
Willard, may I sit down?
I don't care.
Didn't you once tell me you'd like to go up against Smoke Jensen?
If the conditions are right.
By conditions, do you mean money?
Money is one of the conditions I mean. I'd also like to have an edge. A man is a fool if he goes into a gunfight without an edge, especially if it's against someone like Smoke Jensen.
Suppose I get something set up for you where the conditions are right. Would you be interested?
How are you going to make the conditions right?
I'll pay someone to back your play.
How much will you pay me?
$1,000 after it's done.
Hell yes. Let's do it.
Smoke was standing at the bar of Lewis's Saloon having a drink with Sheriff Carson when Jake Willard stepped in.
Jensen! I'm calling you out!
The sheriff smiled at the man.
Willard, I'm glad you showed up. That paper on you, this keeps me from having to go look for you. Why don't you just take your pistol out real slow and put it on the table there? I'll take you on down the street to the jail and hold you until someone comes to get you.
Do you really think I'm crazy enough to do that?
No, I think you're crazy enough to draw and smoke and get yourself killed. And that's fine with me. Either way, it ends for you today.
Draw, Jensen!
A few minutes later, Sally came rushing into the saloon.
Are you all finished with your shopping?
Smoke? I come in here to see that you've been in a gunfight, and all you can say is whether or not I'm finished with shopping?
I'm sorry. Am I not supposed to ask such a thing?
Oh, you're impossible. Well, who was he?
His name was Jake Willard.
I've never heard of him. Is he someone who had a grudge for you?
Evidently so, though I don't know why.
Deacus Templeton came into the saloon after he heard the shots. He ambled over to the small group, having overheard Sally and Smoke's conversation.
He was over in the brown dirt a few minutes ago. I went over to talk to him, but he didn't give me any idea he was going to do something like this.
What were you talking to him about?
I'll be honest with you, Sheriff. I was discussing the possibility of him working for Long Trek.
As a cowboy?
No, sir. As a private detective, so to speak, to see if we can't get a handle on all the cattle rustling that's going on.
Smoke, have you had any problem with cattle rustling?
Nope.
Neither has anyone else in the county, as far as I know. At least, nobody else has filed any complaints about it.
When the colonel met with the Cattlemen's Association, no one else seemed to have a problem either. And I think I've got that all figured out as to why.
Why?
I think it might be because Colonel Garneau is new, and he's a Frenchman. The rustlers probably think he's an easy target, only they've got another think coming. I'm making it my business to hire men who can deal with them.
Like Jake Willard?
I didn't hire him. As it turns out, I reckon it was a good thing I didn't.
Brooklyn, New York. Malcolm Theodore Puddle was a shipping clerk for the Brooklyn Transit Company. It was not a job he particularly liked, but it paid well, and he was conscientious about his work. He was handling a bank shipment of $10,000 in cash that had been delivered to him by an armed messenger. Malcolm had to stay beyond his usual quitting time because the money could not be out of his sight until it was put on board one of the car floats, a barge that ferried railroad cars across the Hudson River. Earlier, he had stepped into Henry's cafe and arranged to have his dinner brought to him that evening. But it was getting close to 7 and still no dinner. He was beginning to wonder if Henry had forgotten. Since it was something Henry had done for him many times before, Malcolm decided he must have just gotten very busy at the last minute. Glancing up at the clock, he saw that it was getting close to 8. The car barge would leave at 8:30. If he had known it was going to take this long, he would have waited until after he got the money shipment on board, then gone to the cafe to eat.
Teddy, what took you so long? I'm about starved.
He looked up then to see two men coming into the office, and he didn't recognize either one. He stood up and backed away from the desk.
Where's Teddy?
Oh, he's back at the cafe. They got real busy when my friend Toby and I were coming this way anyway. So he gave us your supper. Oh, and the key.
The man smiled, holding the key out toward Puddle.
He told me to be sure and give the key back to you.
Thank you. You can put the food and the key there on the desk.
I'd rather not. Henry now, he was very particular about telling us to put the key directly in your hands. And if you don't mind, that's what I plan to do. Put it right in your hands.
Both men stepped around the desk toward him, and Toby took a cloth and a small bottle from his pocket. Malcolm had no idea what it was or what Toby had in mind, but he didn't like it.
I told you, put the food and the key on the desk. Except for deliveries, no one is allowed in here.
Ah, deliveries. You mean like the $10,000 delivered to you today?
Malcolm realized his suspicions were well-founded, and he moved away from the desk into an open area. Malcolm stood 5 feet 9 inches tall and weighed 155 pounds. The two men were longshoremen, over 6 feet tall with a good 200 pounds of muscle. They didn't expect any problem with Malcolm. But they got it. Malcolm was a middleweight boxer who had 23 fights under his belt and not one loss. Sid was the first one to be surprised.
Grab him, Costacani!
Toby watched in disbelief as the little clerk of a man handled Costacani.
Why, you little creep!
Toby swung a powerful roundhouse right, which Malcolm just danced away from.
Costacani, get up and help me!
Malcolm stepped over to Costacani and kicked him in the side of the head. As Toby rushed toward him, Malcolm skipped to his right. Then, putting everything he had in his left fist, he drove it into Toby's Adam's apple.
Wow!
Looking toward the voice, Malcolm saw the cafe delivery boy.
Teddy, are you all right?
Yes, sir. They held something over my nose and it made me pass out, but I'm all right now. Wow, Mr. Puddle, you sure can fight.
Malcolm picked up the bottle.
Chloroform.
I'm sorry I let them take the key away from me.
It wasn't your fault. I'm just glad you're all right. Do me a favor, will you, Teddy? Run down to the corner, tell Officer Casey what happened. Ask him to come here.
When the policeman showed up a couple of minutes later, Malcolm was sitting calmly at his desk, eating his dinner. The two big men were sitting on the floor.
Holy Mary. Would you be for telling me what this is all about?
Let's just say I had some unwanted visitors. I think they were intent on robbing me.
I used the call box to contact the station. There'll be a paddy wagon here shortly. Are you all right?
I'm fine, thanks.
He whooped both of them, Officer Casey.
I should say he did.
Long Trek Ranch.
I think it's time to move on to the next step.
What step would that be?
Now, Colonel, my job is not only to convince these people to sell to you, it's also to keep your name out of anything that might happen. Believe me, you'll be better off if you don't have any idea about the details of how I go about getting them to sell.
Yes, yes. I think you are right.
I'm going to ask you to do something that's for your own good. I am told that you, sometimes visit the girls at the Brown Dirt Cowboy.
Is that any business of yours?
It's none of my business at all. But if you ever had an interest in spending the night with one of the girls there, let's say to have someone who could tell the sheriff where you were in case you had to establish an alibi, well, tonight would be that night.
I see. That is, to keep my name out of whatever you have planned.
Yes, sir. That's it exactly.
There is a young woman named Amy. I think spending the night with her could be quite pleasurable.
That night, Templeton sat in his saddle, looking down upon the farm of Herman Drexler from a low hill. The house and barn were clearly visible in the moonlight. There was no bunkhouse. Drexler's farm was too small for him to have employees. Drexler, his wife, and his young son worked the farm by themselves. There was no movement in or around the house, which was good. Templeton reached down to make certain the can tied to the saddle horn was secure as he rode down toward the barn. He stopped on the opposite side from the house, so if someone happened to be looking out the window, they wouldn't see him. He reached up to take the can down. Opening the lid, he started splashing the liquid onto the wide, weathered boards. When the can was empty, he tossed it aside, lit a match, and held it against one of the soaked boards. He remounted and rode away, keeping the barn between him and the house. Seconds later, 12-year-old Jimmy Drexler came bursting out of the house, running toward the barn. He was trying to save his beloved horse named Duffy. Drexler rushed outside just in time to see Jimmy running into the barn. By that time, the barn was fully involved in flames.
Jimmy! No!
Drexler ran to the door of the barn, intended to drag his son out, but the flames were so intense he couldn't go any farther.
Jimmy, get out of there!
Drexler had to leap away to avoid having the barn collapse on him. He stood in numbed shock, looking at the fire which he knew was a funeral pyre for his son. As the sun came up the next morning, the air was full of the smell of smoke and the odor of burned flesh. Several of Drexler's neighbors, drawn by the smoke, had arrived. The women were in the house comforting Mary Drexler. The men were outside with Drexler, looking at the blackened and smoldering remains of the barn. The bodies of the horses and the cow were easily seen as they were large enough to stand out. But it took a while before they actually located young Jimmy's body. They found his charred remains on the ground, his arm toward one of the charred horses, as if he'd been holding a rope to lead him out. If there had been a rope, it had been totally consumed by the fire.
Whatever possessed him to run into the barn when it was on fire?
He ran in to save the horses. His horse.
He was a brave young man. Not much comfort there, no, but he can be proud of his courage.
I don't want his mother to see him like this.
Don't worry. We'll get him out of here and in a nice coffin before she has a chance to see him.
Mr. Puddle? Drexler? Come here. You might want to see this.
The three men answered Woodward's call.
What is it, Charles?
Look here. That's a kerosene can. There's no doubt in my mind but that this fire was started.
Started? By who?
Who's been trying to run the rest of us out of the valley?
The Frenchman!
After Jimmy Drexler's funeral, Smoke went to Longmont Saloon and sat at a table with Lewis, Charles Woodward, and Humboldt Puddle.
Someone set fire to Drexler's barn. There's no doubt about that. In my mind, whoever burned the barn also killed the boy. Jimmy set a world of store by that horse of his. Duffy, he called him. I remember the day he got him. He rode all the way into town just to show his horse off.
I remember that, too. But how do you know it was arson?
Because we found an empty kerosene can behind the burned-out barn. That arrogant Frenchman did it. Of that, I have no doubt.
Whoa, hold on. I'm French.
You ain't French, Louis. You're a backswamp Cajun from Louisiana.
My heritage is French.
Is it?
Well, backswamp Cajun French.
I would have suspected Garneau as well, but it couldn't have been him.
Dan Norton came walking over to the table.
How do you know it couldn't have been him?
Because on the night the Drexler barn was burned, he was at the Brown Dirt Cowboy. He spent the night with Amy Kersley. They had breakfast together at Delmonico's the next morning. Everyone who was in Delmonico's that morning said he was there and that he seemed surprised when they told him about the fire. Besides which, that carriage of his, you know, the green and yellow one with that fancy design on the doors? Well, sir, it sat out in front of the livery all night long. I was deputy that night and I seen it there.
Does he spend many nights at the Brown Dirt?
We asked Emmett Brown and he said that was the only night Garneau had ever spent there. Brown owns the place, so he ought to know.
Did you say the girl with him was Amy Kersley?
Yeah. Why?
Amy used to work here, but she started doing a little business on the side, if you get my meaning. I don't let the girls who work here do that, so she left and went down to work for Emmett at the Brown Dirt. Wait a minute. Olivia said something about Amy just this morning.
Louis looked around the room until he saw Olivia.
Olivia?
The girl came over to Louis's table.
Olivia, didn't you say you saw Amy Kersley in Goldstein's Mercantile the other morning?
Yes, I did. Why?
What was it you said about her?
Oh, I said she was buying one of those expensive new hats the Mercantile got in. And I was just wondering where she got the money.
Thank you. Maybe Garneau paid her to say that he was with her.
Except Emmett Brown also says the Frenchman was there all night.
That's convenient for Garneau, isn't it?
Yeah, you might say it's almost too convenient. As if he purposely stayed the night just to establish an alibi.
Well, what's the sheriff going to do about it? Next to you, Smoke, the Frenchman's now the largest rancher in the entire county. I can't see the sheriff arresting him on suspicion.
No, but we can keep an eye on him. I'm sure he didn't burn the barn himself, but I wouldn't put it past him to have hired someone to do it.
Smoke, how much do you know about this man he has working for him, Deacus Templeton? Have you ever heard of him before he came here?
No, I can't say as I have.
Well, I've been hearing things about him. You know how people talk. There's no proof, mind you, and as far as I know, he was never arrested or even suspected of it. But there are stories that he once rode with the James Gang.
The James Gang? You mean Jesse James back in Missouri?
That's what I've heard. But, like I said, there's no proof of it. Just rumors.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and what makes it more interesting is that whenever one of the small ranchers is approached and made an offer, it's Templeton who's been doing it. And they all say the same thing about him.
What's that?
They say he scares the bejesus out of them.
Has he ever threatened them in any way?
No. Sheriff Carson asked that very same question. They all say Templeton hasn't done anything to actually threaten them, but there's just something about him
after
that scares them
nevertheless. After a long discussion and many hours of soul-searching, Herman Drexler and his wife decided it was time to go back to Pennsylvania. He stopped by the land office to complete the sale of his land to Colonel Garneau.
$300? That's the offer?
That's the offer.
But I don't understand. His first offer was for $1,000.
You should have taken the offer when it was first made. Then you were in a position of control. You had land that he wanted. Now you're in a position of weakness. You need to sell your land, and you want someone to buy it.
But $300 will barely pay our way back if we ship furniture.
That, Mr. Drexler, is not my problem.
All right, I'll take it.
Smiling,
I don't want
Perkins
to,
counted out the money, then presented the deed for Drexler to sign over the property to Lucien Garneau.
$300, Colonel. That's all it cost you. We got Drexler. The others will come around.
How are you going to do that? You can't burn everyone's barn.
We don't have to burn everyone's barn. We don't have to burn any more barns. But we may have to show a little strength, and I know just where to start.
Where?
With Humboldt Puddle. From everything I've been able to learn, he's their leader. If we can convince him to leave, right on the heels of Drexler leaving, the rest of them will fold like a house of cards. Daniels, Babcock, and now Drexler. I'm telling you, getting Puddle's land will do it for us.
All right. Do whatever you have to do to get Puddle to sell out to us.
Humboldt Puddle had his wagon up on a stand and the wheel removed. He was packing the wheel hub with grease when he saw a rider coming toward him. Wiping his hands as clean as he could, he reached into the bed of the wagon and turned the rifle so the barrel was pointing toward the approaching rider. It wasn't that he was an unfriendly man. Under normal conditions, he would welcome a stranger, offer him water, maybe even invite him in to take a meal with him. Since his wife had died of the fever, he actually enjoyed company every now and then. But these were not normal conditions. Garneau was increasing the pressure on everyone to sell their land. Drexler had sold out and left right after they buried their son.
That's far enough, mister!
The man had come within 30 feet of him. That was not a distance he had chosen arbitrarily. He knew from that distance he couldn't miss, even if he had to fire from the hip.
Well, now, that's not very friendly, is it, Mr. Puddle?
I'm not exactly in the mood to be friendly. What do you want?
My name is Templeton, Mr. Puddle. Deacus Templeton. I'd like to talk to you. You're an important man in these parts. One all the other ranchers here in the valley look up to.
I wouldn't say that.
No, you wouldn't say that because you're a modest man.
What do you want to talk about?
I work for Colonel Garneau, Mr. Puddle.
The Frenchman?
He's from France, that's true. But now he's an American.
He'll never be an American.
I'm sorry you feel that way, Mr. Puddle.
Templeton started to dismount.
I don't believe I asked you to get down, Mr. Templeton.
Well, that's not very neighborly of you.
Neither's burning a man's barn, especially when his boy gets killed trying to save the horses.
Are you accusing me of that, Mr. Puddle? Because that was just a real tragedy, his boy getting killed like that. And I don't appreciate being blamed for it.
Who said I was blaming anyone? All I did say was that it wasn't a very neighborly thing to do. What do you want, Templeton?
As you may know, Colonel Garneau is trying to expand his land holdings, and he's made offers to buy many of the smaller ranches in the area, at a generous price, I might add. I'm sure you've heard by now that he bought the Drexler place.
Yeah, I heard. I also heard what he paid for the place. And if you call that a generous price, then you and I have totally different ideas as to what's generous.
Well, of course, if Drexler had sold his place to Colonel Garneau when the offer was first made, I think everyone would have called it generous. But he waited too long. He waited until he had no choice but to sell the place. As it was, he was real happy to sell, even though he didn't make as much as he would have if he had listened to reason when the offer was first made. I mean, what with losing his boy like he done, well, he was just real glad to get enough money to leave here and start over again.
How could he possibly be happy with getting about one-fourth what it was actually worth?
Yes, well, that was a case of Drexler wanting to get on with his life, you understand. It created what you might call a buyer's market.
What are you doing here, Templeton?
Colonel Garneau wants to buy your place.
It ain't for sale.
He's prepared to give you $40,000 for it.
$40,000? That's considerably more than the place is worth. Why'd he be willing to pay so much?
Because Colonel Garneau is a very generous man.
I can't see him being that generous.
Well, let's put it this way. The Colonel feels that if you sell out, you being sort of a leader and all, well, the other smaller landowners will also sell out.
So I'm to be the Judas goat, is that it?
Yeah, you might put it that way. How old are you, Mr. Puddle?
What does my age have to do with anything?
You look to be a man at least in your 50s, is that right?
I'm 58 years old.
A man your age, working on a ranch, can't be that easy for you. But if you was to take the $40,000 Colonel Garneau is willing to give you, why, you could go to some place like Denver and live just real comfortable for the rest of your life. What do you say?
I say I'm not interested, and I'll thank you to get off my place.
Puddle. You're going to leave this land, and how you do is up to you. You can do it easy, with money in your pocket, or you can wind up leaving it like Drexler did, with barely enough money to get to someplace else.
Puddle had never left his position behind the wagon, and he'd not exposed the fact that he was armed. He lifted the rifle now, holding it cradled across his folded left arm.
Get off my land!
You're not planning on shooting me, are you? Because let me tell you, that's an awesome thing, shooting a man. Most men don't have the stomach for it.
Is that a fact?
Yes, sir, that is a fact. Chances are, if I was to make a move toward my gun now, you'd hesitate just a second before you pulled the trigger. I mean, thinking about killing and all. And that second is all I'd need.
Try me. I was with Burdan sharpshooters at Gettysburg. I killed 14 men in one afternoon, Mr. Templeton.
Templeton said nothing, but the smile on his face faded.
Now, like I said, Templeton, get off my place.
Templeton stared at him for a moment longer, then turned and galloped away.
He turned down an offer of $40,000? Why, that's 200,000 francs.
He's a stubborn man.
I thought you said you could convince him to sell.
Yeah, well, I thought if we could get Puddle to sell, most likely the others would come around. But maybe we're going about this backwards. Maybe if all his neighbors sell and he's left absolutely alone, he'll have a change of heart.
Didn't you say that as long as Puddle hangs on, the others will?
Babcock's gone. Daniels and Drexler both sold out. I'm certain we'll find someone else we can convince to sell to us. I'll do a little more probing.
Marvin Buttram wasn't a rancher. He was a farmer, trying to make a living for himself, his wife, and two children on half a section of land, 320 acres. The crops were coming along so well that he and his wife Emma were already making plans to add another room to their house. In addition to their cash crops of wheat and corn, they also had a rather sizable garden, with produce from their garden, meat from pigs and chickens, and milk and butter from their cow, they were totally self-sufficient. At the moment, Buttram was in the machine shed. He was thinking about how much better off he was in Colorado than he'd been back in Arkansas, where he had sharecropped a cotton farm. He was sharpening a plow shear when a shadow fell across him.
Mr. Buttram, I wonder if we might have a little talk.
Looking up in surprise, Buttram saw a man standing in the door of the machine shed. He recognized him immediately as the man Garneau had hired to run the farmers and small ranchers out of the area.
What are you doing here, Templeton?
Nah, Mr. Buttram, that isn't very nice of you. I call you Mr. Buttram, and you don't have the courtesy to call me Mr. Templeton? Oh, I've brought a few of my associates with me.
Templeton stepped away from the door, and Buttram saw three mounted men outside. All three had their pistol holsters prominently displayed.
I want you to meet Oliver Nixon, Pete Curtis, and John Noble. I've never worked with three finer men.
What do you want?
We want to do a little business with you, Mr. Buttram.
I know what kind of business you want to do, and I've told you before, I'm not interested in selling my farm.
Colonel Garneau is willing to pay you $1,500. That's a fair price.
I can earn that in 2 years. Why would I be interested in selling my place, especially this year?
Oh, I don't know. Crop failures, maybe. No drinking water. Famine, fire, flood. There are all sorts of reasons a person might want to leave a farm.
Yeah, well, none of that is my concern. I got a well full of water, and this year I expect to have the best crop since I moved out here from Arkansas.
You may have a well full of water, but it's no good if the water's bad. And your water's bad.
My water's bad? What are you talking about? Why, I've got the sweetest water in the entire county, if not the state.
You may have had the sweetest water, but that was before a pig stumbled into your well and died.
Why, no such thing. How would a pig stumble into my well?
That's a good question. And now that I think about it, the pig didn't stumble. He was thrown in.
What? Good Lord, man, help me get him out.
All right, we'll help you, though it might be too late. It's already too late to save your wheat crop.
Too late to save my wheat crop? What are you talking about?
Buttram stepped past Templeton and out of the machine shed and looked toward his wheat field. Smoke billowed into the sky.
My God! The wheat's burning!
Yeah, it does appear to be, doesn't it?
You gotta help me! We gotta get the fire out!
Look, it's a shame about your wheat, Buttram.
Buttram glared at Templeton, but he knew he was absolutely powerless to do anything.
All right, you win. I'll take the $1,500.
You'll take $1,500. What $1,500 would that be?
What $1,500? You know damn well what $1,500. I'm talking about the $1,500 you just offered for my farm.
Oh, but that was when you had water and a crop. Surely you don't think it's worth that now.
Well, what's it worth now?
$500.
$500? Are you crazy?
But it's only worth $500 now, while you still have a house.
You're out of your mind if you think...
You were saying?
All right. I'll take it.
That's very smart of you, Mr. Buttram. I'll come back tomorrow. If you have your wagon loaded, I'll give you the $500.
Lucien Garneau poured brandy into a snifter, whirled it around, and lifted it to enjoy its nose. He didn't offer any to Templeton.
Tell me, Monsieur Templeton, how many peasants have you convinced to move?
4 so far. And in every case, you were able to buy the land for much less than the property was worth.
What about those men who were killed in town the other day? I'm told they had papers on them, recruiting them to come work for me.
Yeah, they were coming to join us when they got themselves killed.
They were killed by the keeper of a drinking establishment. Monsieur Templeton, if the quality of your recruitment is such that they can't even deal with the manager of a saloon, how can I have confidence in those we have gathered?
Louis Longmont isn't your average saloon keeper, and he wasn't alone. Smoke Jensen was with him.
Smoke Jensen, ah yes. Am I right in assuming it is he who is my greatest adversary?
Yeah, he is, but I don't think he will be for much longer. I plan to hire a particular couple of men to solve that little problem for us. Permanently.
2 attempts had been made on Smoke Jensen. 1 unauthorized attempt by 3 men coming to Long Trek, but who had not yet been hired, and the other by Jake Willard, who Templeton had promised $1,000 if he killed Jensen. Neither attempt had been successful, so Templeton decided to try again. He was discussing the problem with 2 men, Crenshaw and Harding.
I don't know as I'd want to go up against Jensen. I mean, even if there is 2 of us.
That's the beauty of my plan, Crenshaw. You won't actually be facing him at all. If you use the plan I've got worked out for you, you'll shoot him from an ambush, and he'll never even see you.
What you're saying is, we'll dry gulch him, right?
Yeah.
Well, that don't hardly seem fair, do it?
Do you have a problem with that, Harding?
Hell no. That's about the best idea I ever heard.
Then we are in agreement.
Damn right we're in agreement.
2 days later, Crenshaw and Harding tied their horses off to one side of a line shack at the extreme edge of Smoke Sugarloaf Ranch.
Shouldn't we take these horses around back? Now, if we leave them tied out here, Jensen will see them, won't he?
We want him to see them. When he sees a couple strange horses tied up at his own line shack, he'll come to investigate. We'll be waiting inside, and when he gets close enough, we'll shoot him right out of the saddle.
Yeah. How much did Templeton say he would give us?
$500. That's $250 apiece, which is damn near year's wages if you're punching cows.
The 2 men went into the line shack and had a look around.
Damn, I ain't never seen a line shack this clean before. This looks more like a house downtown than it does a line shack.
Huh, there's something tacked onto the cabinet there. A note.
Harding went over to read it.
What's it say?
It says, Stranger, you are welcome to use this shack as shelter for a few days. You'll find the makings of coffee in the cabinet, also a few cans of beans and peaches. Use what you need, but leave some for others if you can. And when you leave, please leave the shack as clean as you found it, Jensen.
Well, now, that's just real nice of him, ain't it? You almost hate to kill a real nice man like that.
Let's open us a can of peaches. I like peaches.
Yeah, good idea.
Crenshaw took down two cans of peaches and, using his knife, opened both of them. For the next few minutes, they ate the peaches out of the can. Then Crenshaw tossed his can into the corner, spilling juice on the floor.
How's that for leaving it clean?
Quiet! There he is.
Crenshaw walked over to the window and saw a single rider approaching. Both gunmen jacked around into the chambers of their rifles and waited. Smoke Jensen liked to ride around his ranch. He justified it by saying it was good to have a look for several reasons. To make certain no calves were in trouble anywhere, to make certain no cows were stuck in a mud wallow, and to check out that there was an adequate flow of water. But the truth was, it was something he enjoyed doing. He hadn't inherited this ranch. He had built it himself, and he was proud of it. While making a routine ride around his ranch, he saw two horses tied alongside the line shack. Knowing none of his cowboys were there, he wondered who it might be. It was more a thing of curiosity than concern. He didn't mind the occasional itinerant using the shack for shelter, just as long as it wasn't abused. He rode over to the shack for a visit to let them know they were welcome and to see if they needed help of any kind. Both bullets struck the horse, instantly killing it. The horse fell on Smoke's leg and he was pinned beneath it. He needed to be in position to defend himself. He stretched to recover his pistol. It had fallen out of the holster when it hit the ground, but it had slid just beyond his grasp. As he stretched, he saw two men leave the cabin, mount the horses he had seen tied alongside, then come riding toward him, slowly, confidently, arrogantly.
Well now, Crenshaw, what do you think about this? Here's the great Smoke Jensen caught like a rat in a trap.
You know what I think, Hardin? I don't think he looks like a rat at all. I think he looks more like a little helpless mouse. Squeak for us, why don't you, mouse? Now that I look at him, he ain't a mouse or a rat. You know what we got here? We got us a goat, that's what we got. A goat, all staked out like bear bait. And you know what happens to bear bait, don't you? Most often, bear bait gets itself killed.
Neither of the two men had dismounted, and they both looked down at Smoke. Their drawn pistols pointed at him.
Got any last words before we kill you, Mr. Smoke Jensen?
I might be interested in knowing why you're going to kill me.
He wants to know why we're going to kill him. What do you think, Harding? You think we ought to give him a reason?
Yeah, shoot. We can give him 500 reasons.
Yeah. We got 500 reasons to kill you. Each one of them is worth a dollar.
So, you're getting $500 to kill me.
Yeah, we are. Does that bother you?
Well, yeah, it bothers me. I thought I would be worth a lot more than $500.
He thought he was worth more than $500. You're a funny man, Jensen, you know that? Yes, sir, you're a real funny man.
Why are you men doing it so cheaply?
Why? Because it's easy money. That's why. Killing you is going to be about the easiest thing either one of us has ever done.
What if I pay you $1,000 to let me go?
I don't trust you. Now, how do I know you're going to give us $1,000 if we don't kill you?
Well, how do you know the person who hired you to kill me will pay you off?
Well, if he don't pay what he owes, we kill him.
Well, if I don't pay you, you could kill me. That way, you still get the $500 from whoever it is that's paying you.
He may have a point, Crenshaw.
No, he don't have a point. Ain't you ever heard about him? Once he gets a gun in his hand, there can't no ordinary man nor any two men handle him. Let's just kill him now and get it over with.
Say goodbye, Jensen.
The gunmen raised their pistols to complete the job. At that exact moment, Smoke managed to yank his rifle free.
Oh!
His bullet hit Crenshaw in the chest. In a reflexive action, Crenshaw pulled the trigger, shooting his own horse. His horse spun around, causing Harding to jerk his horse out of the way. Harding went down. Smoke kept a wary eye on him as finally he was able to free himself from beneath his horse. Still cautious, Smoke got to his feet and, picking up his pistol, walked over to have a closer look at the two men who had shot at him. It didn't take much of an examination to confirm they were dead. Smoke turned to leave, then stopped and turned back.
Oh, yeah. I think you wanted me to say goodbye. Goodbye.
About an hour later, Smoke sat in his kitchen telling the story to Sally.
You say they were talking about being paid $500 for killing you?
That's what they said.
Well, do you believe them?
I don't think they would have attacked me for no reason at all.
Who do you think was going to pay the money? Do you think it was Garneau?
I don't know. They never said who was paying them.
It had to be him. You know it was.
Not necessarily, Sally. I've made a lot of enemies in my day. It could have been any of them.
It could have been someone else. But you're going to have to convince me that it wasn't Garneau. Please, Smoke, be careful.
I'd better get a wagon hitched up and get those two men downtown to the undertaker.
I'm coming with you.
Why on earth would you want to ride into town with two bodies?
I won't be riding with two bodies. I'll be riding with my husband.
Smoke dropped Sally off in front of the mercantile, and then he drove on to the sheriff's office.
Hello, Smoke. What brings you to town?
Hello, Monty. I've got a delivery to make over to Tom Nunley's shop. I thought you might want to take a look at them first.
All right.
Sheriff Carson put his hat on, then walked out front with Smoke. They walked up to the wagon.
You do it?
Yeah. They ambushed me on my own ranch. Killed my horse.
You don't have to justify it to me, Smoke. If you're the one who killed them, they damn sure needed killing. Who are they, do you know?
I've never seen them before in my life. But I did hear them call each other by name. This one is Crenshaw. This one is Harding. I have no idea what their first names are.
I don't recognize the names. More than likely, they were just a couple of low characters wanting to make a name for themselves by killing Smoke Jensen.
I better get them over to the undertaker.
Is this how you took care of Jensen?
Garneau had just read the article in the paper talking about the justifiable homicide of two men by Smoke Jensen.
I'll take care of Jensen, don't worry. Right now, I'm more interested in moving out those people who are keeping you from expanding.
You have succeeded with four. That means seven remain.
Yeah, but we don't have to move seven. Right now, it all boils down to Humboldt Puddle. He's the leader of all the small landowners in the valley, and if we can convince him to leave, the others will leave as well.
I believe you tried talking to him once before, but without success.
Yeah. That time I used the carrot. This time I'll use the stick.
I do not understand.
I just mean this time I'll be more, let's say, persuasive.
I understand he is an obstinate man.
Yeah, he's hard-headed, all right. But like I said, if we can get rid of him, the rest of them will leave.
Then by all means, get rid of him.
It isn't going to be easy.
I don't pay you because it is easy.
What I'm saying is, we may have to get rid of him permanent, if you know what I mean.
Do it.